You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you all here today. And you probably saw me looking at the deer in the headlights stuck there. The lights are extraordinarily bright. But that's because we've got such a bright panel of discussants here, I think. But I was a little taken aback by that. Perhaps that's because we've actually just today had an incredible embarrassment of riches, as some of you may know, on Europe. We had Secretary Clinton standing not quite here, but over there, giving a major address today on Europe as she sets off next week for a whistle-stop tour of various wonderful European locales, including Brussels and Prague, and I think there's some other places on the agenda. This was somewhat unexpected and turns out to be a great precursor to our planned event with some of our colleagues who have come over from Europe to take part in an event that we do here at Brookings, the Daimler Forum on Global Issues, which is a biannual conference, in fact, that's been going on for about 12 years here at Brookings, also with the Centre for European Reform in London and the Stiftung Wissenschaftenpolitik in Berlin. We have the two directors here. Which looks, obviously, as it says, global issues, but with European political directors and a handful of experts, been going on for about 12 years. So we've taken advantage of that event to do one of our regular series on European topics that we co-host with the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Our friends from Germany, Klaus Linsenmeyer, sitting here in the front row. They're talking all about the current big debates in Europe about its future, the future structure of the European Union. And one of our participants here today, Charles Grant, the director of the Centre for European Reform in London, has actually been very much at the forefront, perhaps in the forefront of the shooting gallery, on this very topic that we have today, the coming multi-tiered Europe. I would say actually multi-tiered Europe is already here. And Secretary Clinton certainly alluded to that in her speech today. But there's a big question about whether it's going to be multi-tiered or two-tier, meaning the UK being out on its own in a group of one as the debates about the EU and further integration, deepening, fiscal union, banking union, and all the big issues that are related to the ongoing crisis in the Eurozone take shape. I see some of you here in the audience today have already debated some of these issues just a few weeks ago on some of these very topics, and I'm glad to see that you've come back again. So the way that we're going to structure this today is my colleague Justin Weiss, who most of you know very well, is going to lead a discussion. And we're going to hear from our colleague Charles Grant, as I've already introduced, from the Centre for European Reform, from Volker Perthes, the director of the Stiftung Wissenschaftenpolitik in Berlin, who is actually an expert on the Middle East, as well as obviously sitting at the head of one of the foremost think tanks in Europe in Berlin. And then our colleague Steve Erlanger from the New York Times has probably got the most coveted bureau position in newspaper land as the Paris bureau chief. It's not Europe or anything like this, Paris bureau chief of the New York Times. And for those of you who have been following the New York Times coverage, you know that Steve has been writing a lot about everything that's going on in Europe right now, and he's going to give us some rational perspective as the American in Paris. So anyway, handing over to Justin. Thank you very much, all of you, for joining us, and we look forward to a good debate and hope it's not too bright in here for everybody. Just as me. But anyway, over to you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fiona. So without further ado, I'll give the floor first to Charles, then to Volker, and then to Steve to focus on the various aspects of the question. Charles?
Okay, thank you. Justin, I'm going to talk about how I see the multi-tiered Europe emerging, and then I'm going to say a bit about Britain. Obviously, one has to make some assumptions about the euro before making statements on Europe's future, and my assumption is the euro will hold together. It's far from certain. It could all go wrong, but I think more likely than not, the Germans will do enough to keep the euro whole. What happens to Greece in the long run, I'm not sure, but my own view is that apart from Greece, I think every other country will probably stay in the euro at least for the next 5 or 10 years. I think we see a three-tiered Europe emerging, which is something new in the European Union. It can be seen as three concentric circles. In the core, you have the euro countries, of course, currently 17 of them. They are increasingly going to give up more and more control over their national economic policies to EU institutions, and they will allow their budgets to be vetted by EU institutions. I don't think it's going to be a federal super state. I mean, you know, Mr. Barroso or the European Parliament may say they want a federal future, but I don't think it's going to happen because there's not much desire to hand over more than is absolutely necessary in terms of economic sovereignty to keep the euro on the road. But I think more economic sovereignty will be handed over and there will be more treaty changes in the future leading to more centralisation of some economic policies. In the second tier, you have the countries that want to join the euro. They've already signed the fiscal compact. That's 25 countries have signed the fiscal compact, everybody except for Britain and the Czech Republic. Most of these countries will join the banking union and accept a common European supervisory system for their banks. And most of these countries will accept much of the centralisation of economic policy making that I described for the centre group, the first tier. And then in the third tier, the outer rim of the European Union, you have the British, the Czechs, perhaps the Hungarians, possibly the Swedes, and the Croats when they join in a few months' time. Now, I think that's inevitable. It's happening already. But it need not be disastrous for those in the outer tier. There is a view common amongst A, British Eurosceptics, and B, European Federalists, who strangely agree on this, that life in the outer tier is just horrible and unacceptable and ridiculous because the inner two groups will caucus, get together, and even on normal European Union business, impose their views on the wider EU, including the outer tier. There's certainly a risk of that happening, but it need not happen. And ironically, it may be the British who actually provoke that and force it to happen against their own better interests, because there will be further treaty change a few years down the road, and it may well be the British refuse to sign a new EU treaty, and because they will ask for opt-outs from EU policy areas in return for their signature, and our partners will say no, and so we'll refuse to sign, and we'll force our partners to go down the non-EU route of treaty change, which they did with the fiscal compact last December, a year ago. And this would be very bad, because if we force most EU countries to make new treaties that are not EU treaties, they'll be intergovernmental treaties, and they will probably have new institutions different from the Commission and the Parliament and possibly the Court of Justice. And as soon as you have new institutions existing at the same time as the EU institutions, the risk of fragmenting the single market is enormous, and the core countries running these institutions, these intergovernmental secretariats, are not particularly economically liberal. It is ironic, as Mario Monti has said, that the countries that are most committed to European economic integration, by which he means services liberalisation, are not in the euro, Britain, Sweden and Denmark, while the countries that pretend to be good Europeans and are in the euro have actually blocked the creation of a single economic space through services liberalisation. Given that danger, I think there is a risk that the core countries and the inner tiers will be more protectionist and less economically liberal than the outer tiers. And if they have their own institutions, they could push a less economically liberal agenda. Now, before I go on to Britain, I've given you the gloomy scenario, but I think as somebody who hopes that Britain can survive and flourish in the outer rim of the EU, it need not be an unhappy story. Life in the third tier could be comfortable so long as Britain does certain things and behaves in certain ways. Firstly, of course, it should have a strong and successful economy, because British influence in Europe partly depends on the success of your economy, and the British economy currently has quite severe problems. Secondly, you need to make friends and win allies. It's a very obvious, banal point to make, but it needs to be made with regard to the British. Just to quote one Europe minister of one central European country I met 2 weeks ago, he said to me, "When we joined the EU in 2004, the British were our best friends. We haven't seen them since. The French and the Germans come courting and talk to us every month. The British are very bad at building relationships with smaller countries and faraway countries about which they know very little, and they need to do a better job of it. Then they would enhance their own influence. Thirdly, they need to take the lead in areas, not just the single market, because they'd be expected to, but in other areas too, whether it's energy, climate change, foreign policy, defence. There are plenty of areas where Britain has expertise, and if they took initiatives, they would win support sometimes, and they'd certainly be seen as better members of the club. And fourthly and finally, they need to behave in a clubbable way. Clubs have rules and clubs have mores. And this is a point that Martin Wolf made recently in the FT. At the moment, the British attitude to the EU is, give us exactly what we want or we'll veto everything. We don't care what the results are. That is what British politicians and diplomats have been saying recently. That's not the way to enhance your influence. So that's my point there, is that Britain could play some influence, have some influence in the outer tier, and could have a fairly happy time there if they get their act together. How many minutes do I have left, Justin?
Three.
Okay,
two,
fine.
Three.
Okay, well, let me just come to the question of whether Britain leaves the EU or not. I think there's about a 50% chance that Britain will be out of the EU in the next 5 years. In order for Britain to leave the EU, two things have to happen. Firstly, there has to be a referendum on membership. And secondly, the British people have to vote to leave the EU because they want to leave the EU. On the second condition, I'd say it seems to be satisfied already. Opinion polls for the last year have shown a clear majority want out. About 60% want to leave and about 40% want to stay. On the first point, David Cameron is going to make a speech between now and Christmas in which he will almost certainly announce a commitment to a referendum on the EU, probably on EU membership, in the next Parliament. What his strategy is the following. He wants to renegotiate the terms of membership and secure a better deal for Britain. As far as the Conservatives mean, that means repatriating powers to the UK, taking away quite a lot of powers that we've handed over to the EU in areas like labour market policies, but also fisheries, possibly its aspects of agriculture, other policies too. They haven't decided which ones they're going to ask to opt out of yet. But they will ask to opt out. And that a lot of Tories believe that Britain is so wonderful and so special and our partners are so keen to keep us in, they'll give us what we want, give us what we ask for. That is, of course, wrong. If you talk to Britain's partners, they have no intention of allowing Britain to opt out of, say, EU labour market rules, which would give Britain an unfair competitive advantage in the single market. However, Cameron imagines he can come back to Britain and say, this is a better deal. Let's have a referendum now, vote to stay in with the better deal or vote to leave. Now, although as I said, I don't think he's going to be able to repatriate much, I'm sure he could get a bit of paper saying better deal for Britain. There could be some understanding on the working time directive, there could be safeguards with the City of London and the single market, a bit of reform with the regional funds, who knows. There could be something. It wouldn't be repatriation of powers. But if Cameron holds a referendum in such circumstances with the Labour Party and the Liberal Party and the Tory leadership, if not the Tory party in the country, in favour of staying in, Britain might stay in. And I'm coming to the end, Justin, but my worry is actually the Labour Party. The Labour Party is more pro-European than the Tory party. They don't want to renegotiate. They don't want to opt out of EU policies. They even like EU social policy. But this is the scenario that worries me. Ed Miliband wins the next election, which is quite plausible. He may be forced to promise a referendum before that election if it looks like the Tories are doing well with their promise of a referendum. At the moment, Ed Miliband says, no, we don't want a referendum, but one may speculate that he will not be able to resist a similar pledge. Otherwise, he will look arrogant and against the wishes of the people. And if he does offer a referendum, it'll be much harder for him to win it than the Tory party if he's Prime Minister, because they don't want to renegotiate Labour, they don't want to repatriate powers, they don't want a better deal for Britain. They think the EU's OK as it is. So with them, it's simply in-out. And with public opinion in the state it is, it would be very hard for him to win. Last word on Scotland, which does impact on all this. As you know, there's a referendum in Britain in 2014 on Scottish membership of the United Kingdom. Opinion polls suggest the Scottish will probably vote to stay in the UK. But the best argument Alex Salmond, the Scottish Nationalist leader, has is this. If you vote to stay in the UK in 2014, you are shackling yourself to an entity that is on an exit path and will probably leave the European Union in about 2015 or 2016. Therefore, if you want to stay in Europe, O Scots, and the Scots are quite pro-European, you better get out of the UK quickly so you can apply to join the EU, and you'll get into the EU about the same time as the English and the Welsh and the Northern Irish leave. So I do think one shouldn't ignore the connection between those two events. I've had my time. I'll stop there.
Fascinating. Volker.
Well, I could basically repeat what Charles said, and in order not to do that, let me say a few words about Germany, because Germany is a country which is driving for more Europe, or where the drive for more Europe, more integration comes from. So probably a few words on the German position and then a few words on what Germany, or what we in Germany think about Britain and about a multi-tiered Europe. Three parameters, I think, are important to characterize the German position in the current circumstances. A is Germany, and that's no news, is committed to European integration, to a strong Europe, not only as we used to hear in the last 50 years for historical reasons, as it were, Europe preserving the peace, the European Union preserving the peace in Europe between the European nation states, but increasingly also because Germans are realizing that in the globalized multipolar world, Germany alone, as other nation states, is too small for this world. We think the same applies to Britain, the same applies to France. Each nation state would be alone too small for the globalized multipolar world. So we need Europe for that. B, Germany is also committed to the, and there were some doubts about that, Germany is also committed to the currency union, that is, to the euro. And I think Charles is right, Germany will in the end do what is necessary to keep the eurozone together. And what we are, that is a vital economic interest, also increasingly a vital political interest, to keep the eurozone together, to keep, to sustain the euro. And what we see happening these days, these months, between the so-called Troika and Greece is basically negotiating the price, negotiating what kind of reform, how deep reforms you need in order to get the solidarity, the financial solidarity of Germany. So we see rough negotiations, as it were, between Greece and the rest. And the German perspective is, of course, as has been made clear more than once, that any bailout, of course we don't use that word, any transfer of funds will only be possible, will only make sense in the long term if there is commitment to solid financial policy on the part of the receiving countries. So that means moving forward to some oversight from a European level, because you don't want the German government to have oversight over Greece. You want it on a European level. That means some reform of the economic and currency union towards a fiscal union, or even in the perspective, a political union. And see, that means if you have that, if you have closer integration in economic policy, closer oversight over national budgets, over national economic policy, you also need to enhance the democratic element of the European Union. You need to have enhanced democratic legitimacy for the whole project, which could happen through different steps, and that is discussed, and it will be discussed. That could mean direct election of the European president or the Commission president. It could be a strengthened role of the European Parliament, or it could be a strengthened role of national parliaments in Brussels. I think that is all up for discussion. Now, if that happens, if Europe gets its act together on the economic front, which I think will happen, then that will make it easier also for Europe to play the role in the world which we think it should play. And I guess it would probably work back on or have an effect on the discussion in Britain. I'll come back to that at the very end. Now, on Britain, on the United Kingdom, it is already the least integrated country in the European Union, less integrated than, to an extent, even some countries who are outside of the European Union in some aspects. So from a German position, there is a very strong interest to keep the UK in the European Union as an active member. And we know that the referendum is coming up, and we would like to understand what the price is that Britain demands for staying inside the European Union. So if we could help, we would certainly be prepared. Why do we have an interest of having the UK staying in the European Union? Basically because having the UK in the European Union strengthens the German position and strengthens Europe as such. Germany shares a lot of positions on economic philosophy, for example, with Great Britain. We share a lot about free trade, transatlantic free trade. We would be much closer to it. It would be easier to discuss it with Britain in the EU than with Britain outside of the EU. And, of course, we need the United Kingdom for a credible common foreign and security policy and common security and defense policy. Germany does accept that Britain is a little bit peculiar, has decided to stay out of the Schengen zone. We don't think it is in the British interest, but if Britain decides so, we accept it. We have accepted that you have decided to stay out of the Eurozone, but I think we would be very, very skeptical, and we wouldn't we wouldn't accept if, in a renegotiation process, Britain would try to exit other dimensions of integration, like exiting from the common social policy or even giving up one of the four freedoms and saying that the freedom of movement for labor would no longer apply to Britain. I think that would be too much for us to accept as a price for Britain to stay in with full voting rights or full decision rights. There are already people in Germany saying that it might be better to have a constructive Britain outside the EU, sort of in a Norwegian or Swiss position, than a destructive, veto-playing, veto-wielding Britain inside the EU, a Britain which would sort of block any further integration step of those who want to go further, would water it down or block it only in order to say, once the other decided that they want to go further, that we are not part of it anyway. So a third-tier position is accepted, but not a third-tier position which would block those in the first and second tier from integrating further if they think it's in their interest to integrate further. The position of us as analysts at our institute, my own position, is that we should do almost whatever it takes to keep Britain in, because Europe, European Union without Britain, without the UK, would be less solid, financial and economic terms. It would be less effective, and it would be less strategic. So particularly for those of us who think about the European Union as a foreign policy actor, as a strategic actor, of course it is essential to have the UK in. At the same time, I think we have learned to accept all over Europe, even among Euro enthusiasts, that the European Union will remain a union of nation states that have different political cultures, different security cultures, different defense cultures. So we will remain different in some aspects where sort of national culture counts. And we do accept that for Britain, but also for France, or probably in the future for Turkey, there is a much more sovereignistic attitude in these countries than in Germany. I guess from a British position, whenever you hear the word integration, for you it means that you lose some sovereignty. And for France, it's certainly so. For Germany, the historical experience is simply different. With more integration, we actually gained sovereignty. Through European integration, we gained our sovereignty. So the attitude, the culture is different here. And it is much easier for us to accept that if sovereignty in the globalized world today basically would be defined along the criterion of the ability to act, the ability to be effective in the world, then probably today you need to give up some national sovereignty and pool sovereignty on a European level in order to be able to act in the world. It's probably easier for us to accept than for others. So yes, I think a multi-tier Europe will be there. It's already there. There is not really a contradiction, as some people put, between a two-speed or a multi-speed Europe and a multi-tier Europe. We already have a Europe of different speeds where different countries agree that they will reach the same goal, but at different times. That is clearly so for the Eurozone. The so-called pre-ins have accepted to be in the Eurozone, but at a later stage. And we already have a multi-tier Europe where we have different zones of integration. And I guess if we look forward, let's say not 5 years, but 15 years from now, that under a positive scenario, we would still have a multi-tier Europe, a Europe with flat ends, as it were, where probably Britain and Turkey would be less integrated than some others, but both be members of the European Union, where we would have some countries outside the European Union who would be associated with some of the integration schemes in the Schengen zone, as Switzerland and Norway are today, and probably even associated with CFSP, with a common foreign and security policy. So that is quite imaginable, and I think it is workable. I guess I stop here. Probably one last sentence, I guess, and it connects the two parts of what I wanted to say. If the efforts to reform the Eurozone bear fruit, and I think they will, I guess it would make it easier for those who are not too Eurosceptic in Britain to convince their public that it's not the best, that it's not the worst thing to remain in Europe. Once European summits are not always under the title of "Are we going to rescue Greece?" but if we can get back in European summits to speak about technology, innovation, common energy market, foreign policy, then I guess it would be easier to convince the Brits that they have a stake in that Europe.
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks very much, Volker. Steve?
Thank you, Justin. I would just want to say if people want seats, there are some here. And if you're happy leaning against the wall, that's fine, too. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. And it's always a bit difficult to come third after two such engaged speakers on this topic. Volker's right about a very important thing. It's already here. I mean, Europe is much less united than we think. I mean, we sometimes talk about Europe, and I wonder why, because Europe is, let's call it, many-splendored, and it certainly has extraordinary structural imbalances and cultural imbalances and historical imbalances that we see more of these days under the pressure of the crisis. And I think that's probably where I would like to start. I would say, having now written about the crisis since it started, everyone's a little sick of it. It's been unconscionably long and unconscionably badly handled in terms of political leadership. This is not a crisis that should have gone on as long as it's gone on. And perhaps it's a truism, but what began as a crisis of an American debt problem and of Greek lying, let's put it that way, has metastasized into a real existential crisis for the European Union and the project. And it has not shown Europe's political leaders at their best, whatever that best is. And it's been very costly for them, but extremely costly, I would also say, for the Greeks, the Portuguese, the Spaniards, and the periphery. And it's been very costly for the image of Europe abroad. It's been very costly for Europe's ability to act, to have a voice as Europe, qua Europe, let alone its other personnel problems, like its difficulty in having a foreign policy chief who can articulate a European policy in a way that resonates, or a European president who's capable of giving a speech to Europeans about why it matters. It's extraordinary to an American why no one ever even tries to articulate to Europeans why this pain is necessary or who's responsible. So I think what the crisis is doing is it's making centrifugal forces stronger. That's obvious. And it's making multi-tier necessary when it used to be a great sin. People would say, oh, my God, we can't have a two-speed Europe. That would be terrible. And now everyone takes it for granted. And that's a shift. And I think one should recognize it as a serious shift and a serious blow to the European project, such as it was when it was initially formulated. And the euro itself, which had a great degree of political magical thinking involved in it, that somehow these economies would come closer together simply through the bills in their pocket and through a certain kind of spending discipline in the Maastricht criteria, which was quickly abandoned, that clearly hasn't happened. And to me, these imbalances have simply worsened. And what you have for many of Europeans, I know it's, it sounds insulting, but the euro is kind of a prison. I mean, they're in it, and they really can't get out of it. It's too expensive. Nobody knows how to get out of it. You can't devalue. I mean, all the countries of the periphery would be so much better off, so much more competitive, so much happier, would actually might get some growth if the euro were at $1.05, I mean, it would just be simple. But it's at $1.32 again. I mean, it's incredibly painful if you're Portuguese, if you're Spanish, frankly, even if you're French, let alone if you're German, yes. But I mean, but the Germans can live with it more easily. And somehow, you know, it's a system that is more kind of moral than any other currency system in the whole world. Everyone else is doing quantitative easing and is doing competitive currency devaluations and, you know, playing the dollar against the yuan, except the euro, right? Because that would be wrong and it's not allowed. And it's a structure that you know doesn't in some ways function to me, in my view, for the best of all of its members. Now, everything Charles and Volker said is quite right. I mean, there's a period of negotiation. Greece is not going to leave. The assumption is that, you know, down the road after the German election and once Greece hits a primary surplus, which it is getting closer even in the depths of recession, and people have a confidence that there is finally a modern system in place, that, i.e. that Greece can become a modern country for the first time in its modern history with a tax system and a legal system and some sense of justice, then okay, then we can keep giving Greece money. And the same process is going on in Spain and Portugal too. One needs to remember these were all totalitarian governments not very long ago. They're very new democracies. And it is not surprising that they're having trouble, you know, creating a system of law and a bureaucracy that works as well as a Germany or a Britain or a France. So, you know, part of these things are structural and historical. Part of them, frankly, are cultural. I sometimes think this whole European drama is this morality play. I mean, Volker is quite sensible, but you look at the German press, and our late friend Ron Asmus used to say the Germans should feel lucky people don't read German, because the German press is really tough. And there's a kind of, it's like death in Venice in economic terms, right? I mean, there's this obsession with the South and the differences with the North, and these are incredibly important political problems, because they simply go to the heart of what is solidarity and what is the negotiation and who can step forward and who can take the public price of acting in solidarity. And it's done great harm among, I mean, I talked to Spaniards and Portuguese and they're very offended. I mean, they feel that Europe was their, you know, solution. I mean, it was their entry into the modern democratic world after the generals and fascism and so on. This was true of Greece also. And they feel that, you know, these same countries that were their models are rather turning their back on them. I think that's not fair. In fact, people have gone out of their way to help save them. But the fact of the matter is it's been done in a rather ugly fashion in which there are sinners and there are saints. And of course, as we all know, that only happens in fairy tales. One other strain, I would say, and Volker and Charles both talked about this, is the issue of defense. I mean, I think more and more you get a multi-tier Europe in a way. The idea of a common European defense and security policy seems to me almost now a risible idea. I mean, no one actually is taking it very seriously, certainly not here. If you want something done, you talk to the British, you talk to the French, might talk to the Italians, you certainly talk to the Turks, and they're not part of the EU. But, you know, you don't actually worry too much about, you know, what EU as a whole might be doing. It's doing nice police work and anti-piracy work and so on, and that's all very, very nice. But the fact of the matter is it's not actually playing much of a role, and I don't think it's going to, not for quite a while now. And then the last point I would simply make, with Justin's indulgence, is it's creating strains, deep strains in the democracies that are part of the Union. I mean, in France, where I live, the center-right party, the UMP, is splitting apart. Now, it's not obviously splitting apart on the issue of Europe, but it's there because immigration is there, and Islam is there, and freedom of movement is there, and these are actually issues about Europe. They're not about the euro, but they are about what kind of country we are, where do we fit in the world, is the European identity sufficient or not? And I think these questions are, you see it in Britain, you have a Tea Party now inside the Conservative Party, which is very serious and just as nuts as ours. And everyone says, oh, it's great in Germany, you know, it's wonderful, we don't have an anti-European party, right, which is true, but part of me says, just wait. I think there are deep strains that are also coming to the fore about these issues of identity and what Brussels means. And I'm also, last sentence, there's something very perverse to me about pushing more political union because of the failure of economic union. I mean, this is ass backwards to me. And it's almost a trick played on many Europeans who have great skepticism about more Europe. And I fear it's going to be one more big anti-democratic project that suddenly people wake up and find themselves caught by. So that's the kind of darker view, perhaps, and why don't I stop there?
Thanks. I have questions for all of you, but Charles, do you want to have a two-finger on?
Just wanted to make one brief comment on this political union, and actually it was a way of mentioning that and responding to something Volker said. Volker, and let me, for the sake of argument, provoke Volker a bit. I mean, Volker said, you know, we Germans believe in a more integrated Europe. Well, I was told by somebody who was there what happened when Mr. Westerwelle, the German foreign minister, had a conversation with Mr. Fabius, the French foreign minister, recently at a European Council of Ministers meeting. And Westerwelle was talking about his report, the Westerwelle report, which, as some of you know, is all about the federal future. It's all about a European army and direct elections of Commission President. It's the classic federalist agenda. And Mr. Fabius said to Mr. Westerwelle, well, it's all very good, your report about the long-term integration, but frankly, you know, we have a crisis in the Eurozone. What I'd like is some short-term integration. Why is Germany dragging its feet and blocking progress on the banking union? Why will Germany not allow the European Stability Mechanism to be used to recapitalize banks? Why is it blocking all progress towards Eurobonds, towards a European deposit insurance scheme, and so on and so on? Fabius's point was the Germans say they're great Europeans. They love to talk about political union, but actually they're dragging their feet quite strongly on any practical step towards more integrated Europe at the moment. So there we are. Just a provocation.
Okay. Well, not too much of a provocation. You're basically saying what the German opposition is saying, that that Mrs. Merkel is doing all the right things after denying that she is going to do them. So she will say we are not going to bail out Greece, and then we are going to bail out Greece after some time. She is saying there will not be a collective responsibility for other people's debts, and of course in the end there will be a collective responsibility for other people's debts. But it is a process of A, negotiation, because if we are going to bail out the others, we at least want them to reform before we bail them out. And I think that is something for the soundness of the economic entity we are going to build in Europe, which is necessary. B, you have to do it for domestic politics. Now, for the first time, and here, actually, probably, I mean, Fabius will have said that to Westerwelle before we had the last decisions on Greece. For the first time now, we will have direct transfers from the German budget to the Greek budget, about €500 million next year. Now, that is something you have to explain to German voters. I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's the right thing to honor the Greek process of reform, but you have to explain it to voters in order not to have what Steve says, well, we will probably at some point have an anti-EU party in Germany. We actually have one, but that's a left party, and it's not a very relevant party. But, of course, there is a danger that we would have an anti-EU right-wing populist party. And I wonder how the press in France or in Britain or in Greece, for that matter, would react if we had something like our Finnish friends have, a party, a true German party. Yeah. They call it a true Finn. Now, if the true German party on the model of the true Finns would gain 19.8% as a true Finns in Finland, what would the French press say?
Or what would the British press
say? Or the British press, for that matter, right? Or the
Mrs. Le Pen got 18%, didn't she, for a
right.
true
or,
French
or,
party.
Or a, right, yeah. a German National Front getting... So I think, in a way, we have to understand that Mrs. Merkel, by her very cautious, not always probably very straight policy, she has reined in this populism in Germany, and I think it's necessary to do that. And in the end, we're going to do the right thing. It's probably costlier in financial terms than if we had done it 2 years ago, but in political terms, it may be the right thing.
Thanks. I have questions for the three of you, trying to push you a bit further on the concept of multi-tier Europe. To Charles, I would ask, I would start from what Volker said about basically the European construction is always allowed for a dose of variable geometry, so to speak, Schengen, the Eurozone, opting in, opting out. So this has, to some extent, always been with us. It has never been formalized in the sense that there are no classes of citizenship in Europe. And it looks like one of the problems is precisely we are starting to be explicit about what classes of citizenship exist. And I wonder, and that would be my question, if that clarity has any merit. It seems to me, on the contrary, that the arrangements that we've had for years, almost decades, have been working satisfactorily, and by sort of clarifying things, we are pushing them, and we run the risk of, for the UK, for example, to sleepwalk out of the EU because we want to put on the paper the balance of competences and what exactly we should be. And then in the end, people, as Tony Blair said in a very interesting speech yesterday, that might never be enough for some, and so there might be a sort of a vicious circle, an accident of the UK leaving. And so I'm wondering if that is a virtue or a vice, and whether, and that's a sort of second question, whether it opens, on the contrary, a more positive thing, which would be to allow for a different type of belonging to the EU, to which some countries like Turkey might be attracted to, right? If we construct a place where you are not a member of the Eurozone and you don't necessarily take part into all of the common policies to sort of adapt a status which other countries might be interested in. So I'd like your view on this question of clarity. To Volker, and I'm just going to ask the question so you can think about it. To Volker, I'd like to... So the premise of a multi-tier Europe is that there will be a very strongly united core around the Eurozone. But I'd like to question that and to push you a bit on that. How far do you think that Eurozone core can go? It seems to me that what we've seen in the recent years is each time there's a crisis and market pressure, then European leaders are pushing a bit towards fiscal union, banking union, more importantly, political union. But as soon as the market pressure decreases, then this sort of fizzles out. And so I'm wondering how far it can go, especially taking into account, and that's the more specific edge of my question, the Franco-German disagreement, which seems to me a very important part of that story. It doesn't seem to me that the French want to go very far in that political union so that the, you know, if we cannot have a multi-tier Europe if the core is not strongly united. So isn't there here a sort of flaw in our discussion? How integrated do you think the core will be? And then to Steve, I'd like to ask you what you think the impact of multi-tier Europe will be on the single market. And this is of utmost relevance, not only for the U.S., especially in the perspective of a free trade area between Europe and the U.S., but also more generally in geopolitical terms. I mean, if the European market suffers because either there's a muddle through and the incentive of deepening the single market decrease, or because there is a multi-tier Europe, and it it turns out to be detrimental to the single market, oh, the UK leaves the EU, and then the single market is weakened. It seems to me that you know, any way you take it, the single market is probably going to suffer. And so my question is, what is the impact of this in geopolitical terms, and especially for Europe's ability to have more weight in the world, because this weight is premised on Europe being a single unified market, and even though its foreign policy might not be sufficiently strong, at least it still has this sort of structural power on other regions. So, Charles, perhaps you want to start.
Well, I accept the tiering model, obviously, but I still maintain, and I'm perhaps biased because I'm a Brit, I maintain that membership of the outer tier, that is the old-fashioned European Union, is still a very big deal. It's still hugely important, and although the core will do their own things on coordinating some of their economic and budgetary policies, the EU itself remains hugely important. It's still about energy policy, climate policy, foreign policy, defence policy, farm policy, regional policy, trade policy, single market. I mean, that's a lot of stuff. Enlargement policy too. Neighbourhood policy. So it's very important what the EU does, however much the core want to merge their own budgetary policies together. So I think my line would be that for the 28 members of the EU, they've got to all be equal when it comes to EU business. They're not equal, obviously, when it comes to Eurozone business. And therefore, this doesn't mean it's any easier at all for Turkey to join the EU. Because joining the EU is a big deal, as I said. A lot of hurdles for anybody trying to get in, whether it's Iceland or Turkey or Serbia or Montenegro or Macedonia or Albania or Kosovo or whoever. So multi-tier Europe doesn't mean it's easier for fringe countries like Ukraine or Turkey to join, in my view, because it's still a big deal. But just one point on the impact on the British debate, which you mentioned, Justin. There are many reasons why the British have become more Eurosceptic. They've always been the most Eurosceptic people in Europe. The reasons are well known, the loony press and the geography and the history and so on. But they've become more Eurosceptic in the last 2 years for a number of reasons. One of them, as Volker said, is the Eurozone's in a bloody mess. I mean, and that's not good PR for the EU. In colloquial English, the EU leaders wouldn't be capable of running a piss-up in a brewery. That's the way it seems to the average British voter. They're so incompetent. They, you know, every single emergency summit they do, too little, too late, they don't solve the problem. That's one reason. Another reason is this core business, really. It's that the EU is changing and evolving, centralising more, becoming much more than the rather limited economic club that the British joined in 1973. The British have always wanted the single market bit of the EU, but have been very suspicious of more than that. And if the EU is becoming, as German politicians tell us in their rhetoric, a political union, then that's not the kind of thing that most self-respecting Brits want to be associated with. So this core business and the more political centre makes it harder for the British to find the EU appealing. And then another factor Volker mentioned, which is a very good factor, is that what is the EU now? It's about emergency summits, it's about treaty change, it's about voting rules, it's about institutions. I mean, how boring. It's been like that ever since the Amsterdam Treaty in 1997. It never gets on to deal with real stuff in the real world, energy policy or innovation policy or climate policy or whatever. These are almost peripheral to this never-ending institutional circus. So, you know, that puts off the British. And the last reason, and I'll stop here, the last reason why the British are becoming more Eurosceptic is that the Eurosceptics, who we haven't talked about yet very much, have developed a rather clever new narrative. Their narrative used to be that the EU is an all-powerful superstate that's unstoppable and will seize your sovereignty and take it away. That narrative doesn't work very well when the EU is fragmenting or finding it difficult to hold together. The new narrative is the EU is a sinking ship. It's a sinking economy dragging down the plucky little British who are tied to the sinking ship. And what we need to do, we Brits, we entrepreneurial plucky Brits, is to cut the chains that tie us to this sinking monster and then do new deals with the dynamic, fast-growing brick economies in North America, which is where all the economic growth in the world is. And that's the way forward for the British. And it's quite a clever narrative. And, of course, a little bit of truth in it. The Eurozone isn't doing very well economically.
Thanks. Volker?
Yes, actually, we had a couple of Tory MPs visiting us at our institute a couple of weeks ago. There were about seven of them. I thought they were from nine different parties. But it was interesting that that two of them said, well, in 10 years or so, if he really gets the eurozone right, we might even discuss entering the euro. And then one other of them said, no, we rather enter the dollar zone rather than the eurozone, which probably meant that both of them realized that in the end, only having the British pound and the British Isles is not enough for the globalized world. But you were asking me for France and Germany and the level of integration that is imaginable. I don't know how far it will go. It will probably not go as far as some visionaries think it should. So the political union or the federation, the federal state of Europe, the United States of Europe is very, very far away. We will have a coordination, strong coordination of fiscal policies. We will have stronger rules. The rules were there, but they weren't very strong. Maastricht had rules. So we will not necessarily have new rules. We will have stronger rules, stronger commitments to the rules. We might have, in form of some form of enhanced structural cooperation, even some coordination of taxation in some respects. Could be useful to have some coordination of industry taxation in order to not have too much of a... how do you call it, competition for the lowest tax rates between countries. That may well be. But of course, countries will do their own budgets, and there will simply be a little bit more of, or a stronger, more effective oversight. What probably is important for Germany and France, yes, we are not seeing eye to eye on many things. And if we speak of free trade, a free trade zone or free trade area agreement with the United States, it's easier for Germany and Britain to have a common position here than for Germany and France. If we're speaking about common market for services, it's easier for Britain and Germany to see eye to eye and all the northerners and for Germany and France. But at the same time, you cannot imagine any integration project or any integration step in Europe where either Germany or France wouldn't be part of it. It would simply not be credible. But unfortunately, you can imagine integration projects where Britain wouldn't be part because they are already doing it. They aren't part of the Eurozone. They aren't part of Schengen. So I guess I can only answer your question to the extent that integration in the economic and social and fiscal field will go as far as Germany and France can agree, and they will have to, and they will do.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Steve?
Thank you, Justin. I mean, I want to talk a little bit first about France and Germany, too, because in a way this is something you could talk about also, so I'm going to try to say some of the things that you might say, but you can tell people what I've left out. In the sense that for France, 2005 and the referendum is a deeply divisive issue, particularly for the Socialist Party, which is in power. And the Socialist Party then divided over the referendum, and Hollande was in favor of it, and as you know, the referendum lost, and it sort of sank a whole previous vision of what the European political union might look like. And it created lots of doubts about what France actually thought. Now the socialists are in power, you know, which they haven't been in a long time, it's even more sensitive an issue. And François Hollande has taken some of the anti-treaty people with him into government because they are key figures in the Socialist Party, including the foreign minister, who was very much against the treaty. But he has been very explicit about not going far enough toward core political union that a referendum will be required. I mean, he wants to be able to do it in the parliament. That's how he did the sort of debt bill, right? And the constitutional court in France basically decided that was okay for the debt bill, but it's unlikely to decide it's okay for more serious steps. So that's a very sensitive point, and it's something he wants to avoid, and it's not a problem Germany has, you know, not in the same way. So I think that's, you know, that is crucial. And also the French, frankly, just by their nature and the nature of the state, they really don't like people poking into their business. I mean, they don't like a lot of oversight and supervision, and not just because deals get done, but because, you know, it's a very centralized state, and they don't actually believe Brussels has much business looking into its budget. So that's another
issue. Berlin.
Let alone, yeah, well, let alone precisely, because what is a more coherent Eurozone core, if it has any democracy to it at all, it's going to be more German and less French. So this is an issue that is under the surface and not actually very far under the surface, which mitigates against too much, you know, unity, qua unity. And then, you know, there are all kinds of issues. I think, just that you said this, and this is very true, that there's more. France would, you can feel it even in this government in its attitude toward plant closings. It's simply more protectionist. It's less liberal. Maybe Charles said this. And it is not going to give that up very, very easily. And that's part of the problem with the single market, it just seems to me. And I'm not an expert on the single market. It just seems, it's just clear to me that if they could ever get it together, it would be an engine for economic growth, which Europe needs very badly. The fact that it can't quite get it together is one more reason why countries like China and Russia, who you'd think would be easy partners for the EU, tend to play countries against one another and would rather negotiate separately, particularly China, than negotiate with the EU as a whole. And with Russia, it's particularly important on energy issues and gas issues and so on and so on. So I do think, you know, it's partly just different theories of how economies should work. French economy is, it's not a liberal economy. And it's not a liberal economy even under the UMP. And it's not going to fit easily into this inner core.
Thanks, Steve. I would like now to bring the room in. And so I'll take a batch of three questions. And so you know the usual Brookings rules. Make sure there's a question mark at the end of your sentence. And please identify yourself before asking the question. We'll start with Dieter.
Dieter Detke, Georgetown University. Steve Ballinger mentioned that if you want to talk about defense in Europe, you talk to France and you talk to Great Britain. And since he's a noble man, he didn't say you don't talk to the Germans. And that's what I wanted to ask Volker and have some explanation. You know, why is it that Germany has to go as far as undermining the effort in Libya in a very dangerous way, undermining EU foreign and defense policy and NATO basically too, and then take the failed merger of EADS and BAE Systems, which could have provided a solid basis for European defense. And again, it was Germany that undermined a possible merger with large consequences and very important consequences for defense. And here is the Arab Spring and the awakening there, and this is part of you know, the southern neighborhood of Europe. And where is Europe? Where is the Mediterranean Union? I never heard about it in the whole crisis, and yet, you know, there should be more being done. So can you help us to understand the German position of, I mean, it's one thing to be cautious and careful, and it's another to undermine unity, and that's what I wanted to mention to you and hope you can help us with some explanation. Thank you.
Thanks. Next to you, sir? No, you don't have a question mark. Yes.
Alex Periter with ASCGS at Johns Hopkins. I wanted to ask all the panelists whether the prevalent narrative of a euro a Eurozone and Europe dominated by Germany has not already been slightly undermined by what is actually happening on the ground when one looks at how the ECB has evolved in the course of the crisis. It's hard to say that the ECB is still the old Bundesbank. It has become something quite different. If one looks at how the new French president and government is positioning itself in Europe, it is quite obvious that the French have recognized that there is a problem of balance between them and Germany, and have actually abandoned the old Sarkozy policy of tightly embracing Angela Merkel and have opened the discussions to other big Eurozone countries like Spain and Italy, who are very, I think, thankful about that. And Angela Merkel is, in fact, now showing much more flexibility because, in fact, the ground is slightly shifting, not so much in her favor anymore. And she is being sort of gently pushed to make more concessions. I just wanted to ask the panelists whether that's a possible interpretation or whether there are some seeds for this interpretation to grow in the coming months.
Thanks. And one last question here in the back. Gentlemen. Yes.
My name is Cvitan Shulimanov. I'm a journalist from the Macedonian Information Agency. This is one of those countries Mr. Grant mentioned as applying for the European Union membership. And my question is, do you see any hope for enlargement of the EU so long as this rule of unanimity, of consensus of all countries remains? Because we've had, maybe my country's example is the most radical one, that Greece, which is fully a failed state within Europe, still has the weight to block enlargement for, and they're not even trying to make it look as a technical reason that it's a deficiency of democracy or anything. They're just saying it's nationalist, it's our right, and we can do it. But as other countries are applying, Cyprus is blocking Turkey. Slovenia is in its second round of attempting to block Croatian membership. Do you see hope for this formal form of enlargement so long as this rule remains?
Thanks. I'm now going to ask the panel if you want to pick one question or answer one or two. Volker, would you like to start?
Well, Dieter Detke, of course, did the provocative question. I wasn't much provoked by questions for Germany's economic or financial contribution, but the defense issue, or our contribution to common defense, is probably the most critical one, especially if we speak of political union, and then we don't follow up and say, what does it mean for common missions of common security and defense policies, for example. But I disagree, Dieter, that Germany undermined European unity in the Libya question. I think that's a wrong narrative of history here. Germany had a different position from France and Britain. Personally, I would have loved us to vote with the Security Council resolution, it's easy for a policy advisor and a think tanker to say we should have done it otherwise. But it wasn't undermining European unity. There wasn't European unity on that question. There were different positions of different European nation states here on the Libya question. And Germany didn't block the NATO effort. Germany allowed the NATO effort to go ahead, and they didn't withdraw their staff officers from NATO headquarters and operation headquarters. So we were in it, even though we don't dare to tell our own public that we were in it. So I think that is the wrong provocation, because it's historically wrong. What is right is to say, if we really want political union or more integration, what does it mean for missions which we want to do together in a more integrated European defense force with a lot of pooling and sharing and relying on one another? Would we at some point give up the right of the Bundestag, of the German parliament, to act as a quasi-general staff and try to decide about any movement of troops? Would we agree that the Bundestag gives sort of a broader mandate an in-advance mandate for European missions if they are decided by the proper European institutions together? Would we even be prepared to give the European Parliament at some point the right to decide about missions? That is a discussion which is very difficult in Germany, and I think we have to lead it at some point.
Thanks. Steve?
And
EIDS, do you want to... Is it a matter of historical record here again? Or, I mean, do you agree with Dieter's interpretation of what happened a couple of months back? Or would you...
Actually, I cannot answer that question. It's not because I didn't want to, because we hear so many different things about... What actually happened when the move, which I think would have been a good move, to have the merger of EIDS and BAE when it was blocked, I simply don't have the information. Mm-hmm.
Steve,
I would say on Libya, I agree with Volker, but the point is Germany undermined itself. I mean, yes. I think with its allies, I think the idea of Germany getting a seat now on the Security Council is gone. I mean, there was a sense it just behaved irresponsibly, and that somehow the bureaucracy screwed it up. I mean, because the only real defense I've ever heard is that somehow they didn't get their act together in time to realize that there wasn't going to be a veto. You know.
No, they thought the Americans would vote differently.
Yeah, but when it became clear that wasn't going to happen, somehow the system didn't respond. So it was all a bit embarrassing. But, you know, the days when the Greens led Germany into war over Kosovo, I don't see that happening again very quickly, I have to say. On Alex's...
You mean the war or the Greens?
That's right. The Greens are coming back, I guess, aren't they? On Alex's point, I think it's very well taken. I mean, things shift, and I think people are a little tired of Merkel, and that helps shift the ground. It's not just that, you know, Hollande isn't Sarkozy. It's also that, you know, she's been undermined by this policy and the anger. It's... The way I always sort of think of it is the race between economic adjustment and political tolerance, it's getting harder and harder, and she is in part bearing the responsibility for maybe perhaps losing that race or getting it tight. And so there's less belief that her prescription, frankly, fits the disease, and I think that's part of the problem. I mean, the disease has as much to do with structural imbalances of the kind that I spoke about before and historical imbalances as it has to do with, you know, budgetary discipline. And as we know, the Irish and the Spanish, it wasn't about their fiscal deficit. I mean, you know, there's just this sense that there's a kind of moralistic, Calvinistic notion that it's just about your wallet, when in fact the problem is a great deal more. But I think you're quite right. And on ECB, I often wonder, I think it was Stark who said he wouldn't do it, because who pulled out at the last minute. But it would have been fascinating to see what the ECB would have been like had he taken the job, which was his for the taking, and Draghi hadn't gotten the job. We might have had a different ECB and a different discussion. You know, so these things... One can't always know. On Macedonia, I mean, I think it's a very good point. I remember Condoleezza Rice, when she was Secretary of State, I don't know how public this was, once suggested that Macedonia change its name to the Republic of Aardvark so it would come first in the phone book and solve the problem with the Greeks. I just think there's enlargement fatigue. And you know, it's less about Macedonia. It's just about, it's such a problem now, and enlargement means so many other things other than membership. It's aid, it's regional funds, it's so many things that I wouldn't expect anybody other than Croatia to get in for quite a long time to come.
Mm-hmm. Charles?
On that point, there is actually some, in Brussels right now, there's a lot of talk of progress on the Greek-Macedonia dispute. So where's our friend from Macedonia? I mean, you perhaps know more than I do, but I hear people in Brussels saying that there's an effort now to overcome the problem and solve the name issue. Of course, Greece has been intransigent, but to be honest, without being an expert on this particular issue, I don't think the Macedonian government has always done the right thing either. It's appeared intransigent at times. Let's hope it can be unblocked. Overall, enlargement, of course, is going very slowly, but I don't think it's stopped completely for the Western Balkans. It's simply that the EU is raising the hurdle higher, and in a way, I think it's right to. It let in Bulgaria and Romania far too soon with crummy, corrupt judicial systems that are not independent. And everybody knows that was a big mistake. And because of that, Croatia's been asked to meet a much higher standard before it can join. And the people who come after Croatia will be asked to meet a higher standard soon. And the EU's, the Commission of the European Union, has actually changed the way it handles enlargement talks now. It's got a new policy, which is to start with the judicial system and the rule of law, and then worry about the other stuff. It used to be the other way around. We used to do enlargement with the rule of law just at the end when everything else was finished. But this is reflecting public opinion, but it's also, in my view, quite sensible. The tragedy is letting in Bulgaria and Romania has damned the cause of enlargement because it was a mistake for which Jacques Chirac and Tony Blair must bear some responsibility, particularly Jacques Chirac. Because of that mistake, enlargement is now an awful cause, and it's very unpopular with public opinion in every EU country, including Britain. Briefly, a couple of other very quick points. German domination. I still think the Germans dominate the Euro debate. As seen from the outside, I think they take the key decisions. I know that Weidmann was overruled in the ECB, but Draghi did have Merkel behind him, supporting him. It would have been very different if Merkel had not been supporting Draghi in outvoting Weidmann on the so-called Draghi mechanism of bond buying. As far as I can see, the Germans set most of the agenda for what happens in the Eurobond crisis, the Eurozone crisis. The French are trying to balance that by working with Spain and Italy and others, but it's still the Germans in the driving seat. And a last word on the single market. Yes, of course, that is what would be. Nothing would create more jobs than moving ahead with the single market. The two areas that need to be moved ahead with are services and the digital economy. There's no single market, proper single market in either. But services, we have a commissioner for the single market, Michel Barnier, who doesn't believe in service liberalisation. We have a government in Berlin that doesn't believe in it either, though some people in the government do. And we have the French government, which is against it. So despite Mario Monti and the British and the Swedes being in favour, nothing's happening.
Thanks, Charles. We can take another batch of questions, and I'll take them all if you can keep them brief, because I want the room to have a say. Could we start here with Michael?
Thank you. I'm Mike Holtzel from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Terrific panel. I'd like to get back to Steve's point about values, European values, and the concentration, however necessary it may have been, the single-minded concentration on saving the Eurozone has been at the expense of I would say, European values. And whether it's the Golden Dawn in Greece or Jobbik in Hungary, an absolutely shameful speech 3 days ago in the Hungarian Parliament, or Vlaams Belang or other places. The fact is, these are worrying. They should be worrying to all Europeans and to Americans too. Now, the European Union didn't deal particularly adroitly 12 years ago with Jörg Haider in Austria, and I think it got burned. And I guess what I'm wondering is there enough energy in Brussels, Charles, for any sort of I'm not even sure what word to use. Intervention would probably offend a lot of people too. But it just seems to me that there was a sense of idealism in the European Union 15 or 20 years ago that I see eroding pretty rapidly.
Thanks. Clara, behind you here.
Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, Senior Fellow at the Center for European Reform and Non-Resident Fellow at Brookings. I had a question for Volker Perthes and Steve Erlanger. To what extent do you think the current developments in Scotland could have an impact on the other secessionist movements in Europe, in particular those in Catalonia and Belgium? And in addition, if Scotland were to become independent, what response might other EU member states take towards this development, in particular towards Scottish membership of the EU?
Thanks. The gentleman with the yellow tie here.
I'm Derek Mix with the Congressional Research Service. A quick question for Charles Grant about how you see the second half of the coalition government in the UK. Is it going to last until 2015? At what point does this become unworkable. And then, Quick, if you were going to try to explain to U.S. policymakers, maybe members of Congress, what's at stake for the United States on the issue of whether the U.K. is going to stay in the EU, why should we care, what would you say?
We're going to keep close track of the questions because I just don't want anybody to be the gentleman in the back, in the very back here.
Thank you. My name is Dominic Toksoff. I'm TAPIE fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations. My questions are mainly for Charles Grant. In the beginning, you mentioned that like this kind of circles of integration, and you mentioned Croatia would be at the outer circle. What makes you believe that Croatia will stay at the outer circle? Because I think like when it comes to administrative capacities, etc., Croatia is much better prepared nowadays than Bulgaria or Romania when they joined the European Union. And also, I mean, all the countries in the Western Balkans have to join the Eurozone after a while, so they are actually forced to join the Eurozone. So here, like, they would be much earlier in the inner circle than Britain or something. And just one quick question about you mentioned the single market has been the main interest for the British to join the European Union. But do you think there is an awareness in Britain already what it means to get out of the European Union when it comes to trade, when it comes to like customs and tariffs that might be introduced again if Britain gets out of the European Union? Thank you.
Thanks. The lady in the back.
Thank you. Penelope Pick from Center for Transatlantic Relations, Johns Hopkins University, a visiting scholar from Bilkent University, Turkey. My question is for all the panelists. Where do you think the need for further integration for energy, internal energy market, stands in the multi-tier EU? And what do you think about the role of Turkey in this respect for further integration in energy and energy security for EU? Thank you.
Thanks. The gentleman here in the front, and that will be it. Almost it.
I'm Basil Scarless. I used to deal with economic policy at the State Department. My question relates to the underlying problem in the Eurozone, which I see it's too much austerity. Is there any hope that the core countries will change their view on that, in particular in light of IMF studies showing that €1 billion in reduction in government spending leads to a 1.5 billion reduction in economic growth, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Right, and last question, the gentleman here in the middle.
Thank you. Enrique Mora from Spain. One question for Charles. You described very well the roadmap for Prime Minister Cameron from here to the referendum, redesigning British membership of the European Union. My question is it your impression that the current European policy of the UK, the attitude for the budget, every single position taken by the UK now, can be read under that light? Is it the current European policy of the UK, the roadmap from here to the referendum, the roadmap from here to redesigning UK membership? Thank you.
Thanks. So we have 6 minutes left, so 2 minutes each. So I'll ask Steve, perhaps in reverse order, perhaps I'll ask Steve and then Volker and then Charles to take the questions that they have been asked specifically and perhaps one other and make their concluding remarks at the same time.
Okay. on Scotland, which was more directly aimed at me, I tried to write a piece about this issue, spinning off Catalonia, using that as a catalyst, as it were. I think it's a trend one sees, and a lot of it has to do with a general unhappiness with the European Union and the crisis which kind of makes these centrifugal forces, which in this case are regional forces, stronger. Now, in general, the regional forces saw the EU as an ally traditionally because it didn't mean so much to be independent if you were part of the EU. I mean, the EU took care of a certain amount of things that nation states would normally take care of. That's a harder argument now that the EU is in trouble. And I think that's part of what we saw in Catalonia, and it's part of the dilemma in Scotland also. And what the EU will decide, I mean, whether Scotland will be could be accepted as an independent Scotland, which not sure is going to happen anyway, as a legacy state, or whether it would have to reapply. I'm not sure anybody knows. I think that will be a model. But what strikes me as you talk to people in these different places, they're all watching each other incredibly carefully. I mean, they're watching, I mean, in Scotland they watch Catalonia, in Belgium they watch and what's going on in Scotland, and I think one shouldn't ignore it. Each country has its own issues, but the Basques, for instance, I think are fairly happy because pretty much at this point they're independent anyway. I mean, I don't think they even pay taxes to Madrid, so, you know, that's enough, right? The other point I would simply make is simply about austerity and the sort of IMF multiplier. France hasn't had any austerity, and it's still unhappy. It is taxing itself into a recession rather than cutting spending itself into a recession. So there are two ways of getting into a recession, and we can decide which one's worse. Europe will give us both examples.
Thanks. Volker?
3 points, perhaps. On Scotland, I think the short answer is that every new state who wants to become a member of the European Union has to apply, and all EU states will have to agree to that state becoming a member. So if England was out and Scotland would apply to get in, that would probably be an easy thing, but the Scots as well as the Catalans should probably understand that that if they would apply to get into the European Union against the wish of London or Madrid, that wouldn't be so easy, because Madrid and London would also have to vote for their membership in the end. It simply doesn't go differently. It's not so easy to simply double or triple the number of EU states by having provinces declaring themselves as states. Then we would probably have Bavaria at some point saying that they would want to be a member of the EU, which of course they are, but as part of Germany. I think the budget question is interesting, but I want to answer it in a different way. I think we should use these budget negotiations to politicize the budget issue, and that would make it much more understandable what Europe is for. I mean, we could really discuss priorities, the priorities of Europe over the budget. I mean, do we want to spend a third on agriculture policies? How much do we want to spend on innovation policy? How much do we want to spend on energy integration? Energy is one of the aspects where Europe actually can show power, even though the energy integration is not yet complete. But in the discussion about what is Europe doing with regard to Russia, the cartel case against Gazprom does show that Europe does,
yes,
that Europe is a real power, and that in terms of energy policy, it has real clout. And Russia, for the first time, I think, is experiencing that Europe is a power there, even in the energy field, which is quite interesting. And that leads me to my last point. I think we should all be clear about what we have Europe for. For historical reasons, yes, we have all been discussing that, keeping the peace between the European nations. But I think that we can take for granted. Now, today, Europe is about our power in the world, and it is about keeping our wealth. And, of course, the two things have a lot to do with one another. And if that is the premise, I think we can have a much clearer strategic discussion about what do we want to have our budget for, why do we want to have Britain in the Union, what kind of integration do we need?
Thanks. Charles, last word.
I haven't got time to answer all the questions. Enrique Mora I'll talk to later, because his question about Britain was so complicated. I will answer it privately. Croatia, well, I don't claim to be the world's expert on Croatia, and if you tell me that they're much readier for membership and have a better judicial system than Bulgaria and Romania, I believe you. In terms of Croatia's PR, it was a shame that your Prime Minister was sentenced to, was it prison or some punishment for corruption only a few weeks ago?
But wasn't that an achievement?
Well, maybe it was. Maybe that's a fair point. Maybe that shows that actually the
process is
right. But you may join the inner tiers. Yes, I mean, you don't have to stay in the third. You have to start in the third tier. You're not in the banking union. You're not in the fiscal compact. And nobody's going to let you in just yet. They want to see how you are. And after a few years, you may be able to join. But you're wrong to say that all the Balkan countries are going to join the euro. No, they're not. Not for a very, very long time. Nobody's going to join the euro anytime soon. I guess the next in the queue, if they really want to continue, are the remaining Baltics, Lithuania and Latvia. Poland might join in about 5 years, but they're in no hurry to join, and nobody else is in any hurry to join either. And don't forget that the countries in the euro vet you before you get in, and Germany doesn't want too many other Greeces to join just yet. So Germany will be, and others will be, extremely careful about who they let in, which doesn't mean in the long run you can't get into the inner tiers, I agree, but it will be, I think, the long run. On energy, Volker's already answered the question, but let me just add that there's a lot to be done and is being done on energy. This year, the EU has passed new rules on energy efficiency, which are binding and enforceable to make everybody use energy more efficiently. Very good thing. We're not moving quickly enough on carbon capture and storage. There are EU programs there so that we can start emitting carbon and then catching it again so it doesn't pollute the atmosphere. The emissions trading scheme isn't working because the floor price for carbon is too low. The Commission needs to reform it. There are connections that have to be built between different national energy grids. That's part of the EU budget negotiations. There's a lot happening in energy. On the UK, why should the US care if the UK leaves the EU? Well, because, as General de Gaulle said, Britain is America's Trojan horse in Europe. He was absolutely right about that. The British tend to think like the Americans, not on everything, not on climate change or Israel-Palestine, but on most issues we think like the Americans. And we are in favour of a more free trading EU, a more Atlanticist EU, a more open, outward-looking EU. So in general, it's very much in the US interest to have us in there arguing for the kind of worldview that the Americans and the British to some degree share. And my last point on values, I'm not as depressed as... Who asked the question about values? Was it Carl?
Mike.
I think values do matter. I mean, what's happening in Ukraine at the moment? The EU is refusing to sign the deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with Ukraine because Mrs. Tymoshenko is in prison. That's because there are values affecting our neighbourhood policy, and rightly so. We've cut off aid to Belarus because of Lukashenko's behaviour. We're giving more aid to Moldova because the Moldovan government is behaving well. In Burma, the EU's done a huge amount to bring about the successful reforms in Burma because we care about the political system in that country. So EU foreign policy isn't all about interests, it's about values too.
Thanks. On these great words, please join me in thanking the panelists for a really...